recorded live.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, along with Pastor William Fink, with another installment of Christogenos. And this evening, we're going to continue in our discussion in the Gospel of John. But I need to make a quick announcement with regard to what's been going on in the chat rooms lately. There's been a lot of gun talk, and, you know, we've had problems in the past with people being nasty to each other things like that. What the gun talk problem is all about, it's not that I'm not interested in gun and not that I want to censor anybody, but the fact is that the entire chat room can be copied, scanned, copied, and sent to the FBI, right? And if we have a lot of gun talk, and somebody is, saying things like we should kill this person or we should kill that person, well, I mean, they can put us off the air for stuff like that. Okay, so we really need to be careful. And you know, there's places Bill and I were just discussing. There are places on the net where you can talk about guns. And then thirdly, I'd like to just. It's not an absolute requirement, but it would be nice if the chat room sort of follows the show as opposed to having discussions of the Super Bowl and things like that, you know, while we're trying to have a show, okay? But by all means, have fun, okay? Yeah.
I'm sorry. I said I would hope they're not discussing the Super Bowl, anything but that.
Right, right. Yeah. No. So we definitely want people to have fun, you know, and then if you get on side discussions, no big deal, you know. But, the gun talk can get out of hand, and they can use it against us, you know. And there's other kinds of talk they can use against us, but usually, you know, people aren't too bad about things like that. So I just wanted to make that quick announcement, and we'll get right into John chapter 11. I think last time we finished John chapter 10, and let me just back up one verse here in John 10. Go to 41, John 10:41. And many resorted to him and said, John did no miracle, but all things that John spoke of this man were true. So John prophesied of this miracle worker here. And verse 42, and many believed on him there. And of course, I think one of the points that we've made throughout our discussions, both on the Old Testament and New Testament shows that we've been doing, Bill, is that there's no command anywhere that everybody should become a Christian, that we should do all our best to convert everybody, and we shouldn't rest until we convert everybody. And that's kind of the mainstream Judeo-Christian point of view. And when you actually read the Bible, it doesn't say that anywhere, okay?
Well, right, it doesn't say it anywhere, but they treat it as a contest.
Right.
Like which eloquent pastor can can win the most souls for God, as if God doesn't have them all counted already.
Exactly.
And that's really that's another vain attempt at salvation.
Yes.
Through works.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a different sort of ritual, right?
Right. Yeah, it's the pastor on the pulpit ritual.
And your work should be helping the brethren that you already have.
Yeah. And so the emphasis becomes in saving souls. And then what they do is they distort the message in order to save souls. And they're not saving anybody, you know, because it's clearly the message is not for everybody, and that's very, very clear throughout the scriptures. It's not for everybody. First of all, it's for Israel, okay? It's for our people. And then the people who are evil, because there's numerous passages that the prayers of evil people don't get heard, okay? So if there's any saving to be done, you have to get them straight morally, and there's no attempt whatsoever by these evangelicals to do that. You know, they teach the feel-good gospel. And I think we're going to run into a lot of these contradictions between modern teaching and what the Bible really teaches in John chapter 11. So let's continue. Verse 1, Now a certain man was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore his sister sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. When Jesus heard that, he said, the sickness is not to death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. When he had heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. Then after that, says he to his disciples, let us go into Judea again. His disciples say to him, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone you, and go you there again? And of course, Jews is accurate here, but the proper translation should be Judeans. The Judeans of late sought to stone you, and go you there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbles not, because he sees the light of this world. But if a man walk in the night, he stumbles, because there is no light in him. Do you have any comments so far in these first 10 verses?
Well, only that he's saying that they're not 12 hours a day, meaning that he has to do the things that he has to do to fulfill his ministry.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
He can't, quit at the 11th hour just because the Jews seek to stone him. Mm-hmm. He knows the time is apportioned.
Right, right. Verse 11, these things said he, and after that he said to them, our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep. Then said his disciples, Lord, if he sleep, he shall do well. However, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest in sleep. Then said Jesus to them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, to the intent you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him. Okay, so he stated twice already that the reason he's literally saying he has allowed Lazarus to die.
Well, right. That's why he tarried 2 days.
Right, right.
He heard he was sick and he waited until he
right.
was dead.
Right, yeah, and sure everybody was wondering, why in the world is Jesus allowing Lazarus to die and not healing him? Okay, verse 16. Then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, to his fellow disciples.
That means twin, by the way. I'm sorry.
Pardon? Oh,
Didymus
twin?
Just means twin. Yes.
Oh, okay. To his fellow disciples, let us all go that we may die with him.
Now, you know, let me say something.
Yes.
First, I have this as a rhetorical question. And the let us all go, that is, Iomen, that is the imperative. And
okay.
What Thomas is really saying is, must we go also that we may die with him?
Uh-huh.
In other words, Thomas is more afraid of the Judeans than he has faith in Christ.
Okay.
And that's why he's called Doubting Thomas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's one reason. Yeah. Now, in other words, doubting was a pattern with Thomas. It wasn't only about the risen Christ.
Right.
It was a pattern from the beginning. Now, there's a very interesting epigram by a poet named Comatas, which is found in the Greek anthology in Book 15 in Harvard's Loeb Classical Library edition.
Okay.
And it has the students. This epigram retells this story. And you know, it's not doesn't seem to be a purposeful changing of the story, since the rest of the story, as the epigram presents it, it is very much like the gospel account.
Okay.
And it seems to be very, very sincere, except one spot where this statement is made. I would read the Greek: "We must go as you command, like you would go to the Father."
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally different than any than John's Gospel has this story.
Right.
And it just shows a whole different attitude from the apostles.
Right.
And Thomas is, oh, must we go also that we die with him?
Right.
And that's pretty cynical. And I just wanted to mention that. And
yeah.
And there's no manuscript evidence supporting it. But this is, in itself, it's an early Byzantine version of the story. And
right.
This one statement is quite different.
Yeah. Well, I read it as kind of a joke, okay? Then said Thomas, okay, let us all go that we may die with him, okay? But
oh, okay. Well, to me, Thomas is being his doubtful self.
Uh-huh. Okay.
He's being cynical.
Yes. Definitely.
And he's
right.
He's being his, you know, he's called Doubting Thomas for a reason.
Yeah.
And he's
yeah.
saying, must we also go that we may die with him?
Right.
And it's a rhetorical question.
Okay, here we go. Let's all get to let's get beat up today. You know, we're going into Jerusalem. Okay. Yeah, very good. Okay, verse 17. Then when Jesus came, he found that he had lain in the grave 4 days already. Now Bethany was near to Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs off. And many of the Judeans came to Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. So in this case, these Judeans were good Judeans. More than likely Judahites, friends and relatives of
Well,
Martha
right.
Mary.
I was just going to mention that contrary to some idiots who you've recently debated, that this story is another example where it makes it clear that there are good Judahites.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
Even in Judea.
Right. Even in South Carolina, possibly, verse 19. And many of the I read that one already. Verse 20. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary sat still in the house. Then said Martha to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother had not died. Which is a fair statement from her. Why did you let him die? But I know that even now, whatsoever you will ask of God, God will give it you.
Well, let me say that that's also an expression of great faith.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
you
yeah.
know, it seems like she's accusing him on the surface.
Right.
Yeah, you know, like, what were you doing if you should have been here?
Yes.
But nah, it's an expression of great faith, knowing that in his presence it wouldn't happen.
Yes, yes. And then he says to her, your brother shall rise again. Martha says to him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Okay, so from this statement, she's thinking, well, it's too late, 4 days.
And this shows the belief in a physical resurrection. Is
right,
like,
right.
And it's much older than this because I think it was, wasn't it Job that said that he knew he would stand with his fathers in the last day?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, that belief has always been with us.
Right, right, yeah. And so certainly the afterlife, as some ministers like to teach, even a few in identity don't believe that your consciousness survives death. It most definitely does, okay?
Well, right. There's even a lot of people in identity that are Darwinist at heart,
uh-huh.
that claim to be Christians,
right.
that think that resurrection is through reproduction of the race.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Yeah. No. Your personality, your selfhood is definitely preserved. That does not get destroyed.
It has to be preserved. There's
yes.
no doubt.
Right, right.
And the ancients believed it.
Yes. Very good. Verse 25. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. Verse 26, and whosoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Believe you this? She says to him, yea, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, which should come into the world. Take that, John Hagee. Okay. And so we've actually, you know, I should have been counting the number of times that either Yahshua, Messiah himself, or other people say, you are or I am the Christ, okay? Because it happens quite often here in these Gospels. Contrary, in effect, the skeptics, the atheists and agnostics, I've read many of them say, Jesus never claims to be God or never claims to be the Messiah.
Well, he claims it consistently.
Yes, he
and
does.
Hagee reads the Gospel of Freud.
Yeah.
He doesn't read the Gospel of John.
Right, right. Very good. Verse 28, and when she had said so, she went her way and called Mary, her sister, secretly, saying, the Master has come and calls for you. As soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came to him. Now Jesus was not yet come into the town, but was in that place where Martha met him. The Judeans then which were with her in the house and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, she goes to the grave to weep there. Verse 32, then when Mary was come where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother had not died. And then let's see what her attitude is. Verse 33, when Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Judeans also weeping, which came with her, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled and said, where have you laid him? they said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. Then said the Judeans, behold, and here I think we can say Judahites, then said the Judahites, behold how he loved him. And some of them said, could not this man which opened the eyes of the blind have caused that even this man should not have died? Okay, they're questioning Jesus. You know, why did you let this happen? Jesus, therefore, again, groaning in himself, comes to the grave. It was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. Jesus said, take you away the stone. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, says to him, Lord, by this time he stinks, for he has been dead 4 days.
Let me say that in the ancient Hebrews, buried people under the ground in like, this would be like a grave like we make, you know, a hole in the ground, but they didn't fill it in with dirt.
Oh, okay.
Their tradition was to leave the skeleton in the ground for a year.
Okay.
And usually after a year, all the bacteria would eat all of the meat off of the bones.
Sure.
And then they would put the bones in an ossuary. In an ossuary, in a stone case.
Right.
And the whole family's bones would be in this stone ossuary.
Okay.
It's O-S-S-U-A-R-Y. I'm probably killing the pronunciation. but yeah, it's and they would move the bones to that, and that
right.
would open up that gravesite to bury the next family member that dies, huh?
Yeah, right.
And that's the way they did it.
Right. So they definitely all assumed at this point that the bacteria started eating away.
Oh, yeah, well, that
Lazarus
would be the stench, evidently.
Yes. In verse 40, Jesus says to her, said I not to you that if you would believe, you should see the glory of God? Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and I knew that you hear me always, but because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that you have sent me. So there's a third time, he says, the reason why we have allowed Lazarus to die is so that we can perform a great miracle in your presence. Verse 43, and when he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. Jesus says to them, loose him and let him go. I'm sure there was a lot of commotion at this point. Verse 45. Then many of the Judahites, which came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did, believed on him. But some of them went their ways to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done. Okay, so there were spies.
Right. I'd like to discuss a lot of this, too.
Yes.
Well, a lot of them would probably go and tell the Pharisees out of spite.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you see all the bad things you've been saying about this guy, and look what he did.
Right.
Not realizing they were running his mouth and just giving them fuel.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean that they were actually spies, although they very well could be.
Yeah.
Like today, I'm sure you had your little FBI stool pigeons running around.
Exactly.
I'd like to talk, you know, a lot of people in identity, I haven't heard a lot, but I've heard people repeat in identity that Lazarus was the first person resurrected from the dead.
Okay.
And that's just not true. It's not true in Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And in Greek mythology, let me say that, Apollodorus in his library in the 3rd century B.C. wrote about the centaur Chiron resurrecting dead people.
Okay.
And Asclepius. Asclepius was actually a human doctor in the earliest Greek writings, who was later deified into the god of healing.
Mm-hmm.
And Asclepius was supposedly slain by Zeus, who was angry at him, and he was accused by Hades of thinning out the population in hell, basically, because he was resurrecting men from the dead.
Okay.
And that's just tales in Greek mythology. But the first evidence is in, and I think it's the only Old Testament account, unless I'm mistaken, is in 2 Kings chapter 8.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. Elisha presents, is credited with restoring a dead man to life.
Right.
In 2 Kings chapter 8, verses 4 and 5.
Right.
And
right.
In Hebrews 11:35, Paul makes the statement, speaking of that the battles of the Israelites against the other nations in the Old Testament, that women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection.
Okay.
So this resurrection for the dead is something
yes.
that happened in Old Testament scripture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. That's my comment on it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, applying it to the case of Lazarus here, you know, because, you know, in modern times we've had a lot of near-death experiences and even death experiences where people, their hearts have stopped.
Okay. Oh, right. But Lazarus is clearly dead.
Right. Right.
And that's right. In Ireland, they called it a wake because when you were found unconscious, that they'd lay you out on a table in the dining room and hope that you woke.
Right. Yeah. Because I think there was statistically, one in 200 or 300, I forget what it was, that actually did come back to life, okay, after they were pronounced dead. And sometimes they were even buried under the ground, right? And in a case like that where someone was buried underground and might have come back to life, they had a string. That string was tied to a bell, okay? And if that guy came to life...
And I've heard that. I've heard that.
That's a bell ringer, folks. That's a true story.
He's a dead ringer.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Because statistically, a lot of them did come back to life. Okay, after several days, you know. So it's not impossible. But here we have a situation where Jesus is bringing him back to life, in the presence of all these people, creating this tremendous stir. Verse 47. Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council, and said, "What do we? For this man does many miracles." Okay, now here he is performing miracles again, and he's showing us up, okay?
And they know he performs the miracles, but they never stop and ask themselves why.
Right, yeah, and it never occurs to them to say, "Oh, well, wow, but that's great. Keep doing that. That, you know, you're helping so many people with your miracles." They never say anything like that, do they? They always resent the fact that he's performing miracles.
And it just, you know, if you stood in a court and a judgment, and say somebody won $1 million judgment against you, and you just pulled $1 million out of thin air and paid it, they wouldn't want to know how you pulled $1 million out of thin air.
Right.
They would want to know where you made that money so that they could tax it.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that they could find more money against you.
Yeah. Yeah. So all of the good things that he has done, these Pharisees hate him the more. The more good he does, the more they hate him. Now, it rarely crosses the mind of the Judeo-Christian to ask why, okay? And the obvious answer is because they have this hatred of him because they're not his people.
Well, that's the obvious.
That's the obvious.
It's the obvious that mainstream Christians just don't see.
Yeah.
And they're still trying to convert those people.
Right. They're still trying to convert the people that hate him and want to kill him.
The next verse, verse 48, and I'll comment on it maybe before you read it.
Yeah.
Verse 48 intones that they clearly knew Yahshua was the Messiah. And they knew that the Messiah was to become the ruler of Israel.
Yes.
All right?
Yes.
And that would have been a threat to Roman power.
Uh-huh.
And that would have caused a Roman reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they were afraid of,
right?
Losing their position due to a Roman reaction.
Right.
Now, we know now that Christ was to die at his first advent.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Yes.
And even his followers at his first advent at that time did not know it.
Yes.
And they tried to make him king.
Right.
And that was a great point of contention after his death, that you know, that whether the Messiah was supposed to die.
Mm-hmm.
And
becoming king, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that was a big struggle that, you know, Paul undertook to prove to Hebrews wherever he went.
Yes.
All right? But in the confusion of the Pharisees, that confusion facilitated his sacrifice.
Yes, right. And their hatred of him. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, so the Judahites, the true Judahites who were expecting the Messiah, also expected him to be king, okay? And so they were disappointed and probably became, some of them became disbelievers because he wasn't made king in spite of all the miracles and all the great things they'd heard about him. But here we clearly have, and let me read verse 48. If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him. And, of course, the word men is added here. I don't know why they added it. It's not necessary. All will believe on him. And the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation. So let's try to imagine what's going on. So your point is that they must know that he is a Judahite in the lineage of the kings of Judah. Okay. Otherwise, he could not take that place. Okay. And so if he took that place and became king of Judea,
that would be a revolt against Rome.
Right.
Because
the Romans,
Rome had been appointing the king.
Right. Right. Well, they're saying the Romans wouldn't like it, but I don't think the Romans would care.
well, they would care.
Okay.
Because the Romans appointed those tetrarchs.
Right. Right.
And the Romans are collecting the taxes from the tax farmers.
Right. Right.
That
yeah.
those tetrarchs are commanding.
Yeah,
and it's the Romans are actually sovereign over the province.
Right. Yeah. Ever since the days of Antipater and Herod. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. My point was simply that they don't care who collects the taxes.
Okay. Oh well.
Yeah.
If somebody came along with a bigger bribe, I'm
right.
sure they could get a better deal.
Well, that's the way it worked in those days, right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Christ isn't about to bribe anybody.
Right. Right. Yeah, very good. So verse 49, and one of them named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said to them, you know nothing at all.
Let me say real quick,
yeah.
I think John is saying this tongue-in-cheek,
okay,
that
yeah.
Caiaphas is high priest that year.
Okay.
Because we all know it's a lifetime appointment.
Right, right.
You know, and he's saying being high priest that year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it'll be
right.
somebody else next year.
Well, I think, wasn't it the case that these Edomites, once they took over they basically declared themselves to be high priests, okay, even though they had no right to.
Well, I think what was happening is that the Romans, at first Herod was appointing the high priest.
Yes.
And then from the time of Archelaus, when the kingship was taken away, the Romans were appointing high priests.
The Romans.
But the Tetrarchs had a lot of say in it.
Okay.
And who was getting the office.
Right.
However,
right.
they would appoint the high priest and leave them high priests until they got angry with them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some high priests in this period who had the office for 20 years.
Okay.
But some of them also had it a very short time.
Yes.
Because they upset the Romans or they wouldn't go along with certain things, and they didn't have the office very long.
Yeah.
However, the word is used in the plural properly here because I think it's used sort of like a that when men no longer held the office, when they were removed from their appointment, they would still maintain the title,
mm-hmm.
An emeritus.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right, right. Yeah, like an ex-president. Yes. Okay.
Well, right, or a general, or
yeah. Okay. All right. Verse 50. Nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not. So here they're already thinking about the fact that, you know, well, if we get rid of Jesus, then the rest of us are saved. Okay.
Well, right, but this is Caiaphas,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to demonstrate in a few minutes that he was a Sadducee.
Okay.
He's not even a Pharisee. He's a
right.
Sadducee. And,
right.
And he was the high priest at the time.
Yeah. So he's thinking out loud among these Pharisees and saying, don't you guys realize that, you know, it's expedient for us to get rid of him. Okay, verse 51. And this spoke he not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation. Now, maybe John is using the word prophesy here, tongue-in-cheek. Okay.
Well, right. I believe John is using the word tongue-in-cheek.
Yes.
Caiaphas is thinking about saving his nation.
Right.
So he wants to kill Christ.
Right.
And that killing Christ actually saves the yeah. real Israel nation.
That's right. Right. Yeah, in the ultimate sense. Yes.
Yes.
Yes, in the ultimate sense, in the big picture. So,
right.
Right, right. Okay, verse 52. And not for that nation only, but that he also should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad.
Now that's the children of Yahweh, and that's in the aorist tense, and I translate it, who had been dispersed.
Okay.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. They were dispersed long ago.
Right.
This isn't talking about the Jews in the synagogues in Greece.
Right.
That this is talking about the children of Yahweh, the Israelites who were dispersed from 745 to 586 B.C. And even before that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And if you don't know the history of our people, we are in John 7:49 through 53. So it's really obvious that in verse 52, that Caiaphas understands that the children of Israel had already been scattered abroad. Okay? And that those Israelites are that other nation to which Yahshua refers in other places. Okay, so.
Well, right, the sheep and other folds.
Right, another fold. I have another fold that is not here in Judea. Okay? And that's what Paul is always referring to as the uncircumcision. Okay? And so the vast majority of your Judaic Christians have no idea that these Israelites are out there waiting to be ministered to by the apostles, and that's to whom they went, okay? We in identity understand this, but they don't. Verse 53, then from that day forth, they took counsel together for to put him to death, okay? And he certainly, Caiaphas, did not want Jesus to go out and recover the scattered sheep and bring them back like in an army, okay, and overthrow them. You know, that I'm sure that's one of the things they were afraid of, okay? But certainly they're plotting here to put him to death.
Well, let me say that that's not as far-fetched as a lot of people might think.
Okay.
Because Josephus, and I have a lot of comments before we move on, if you don't
mind. Oh, okay.
Josephus wrote Wars of the Judeans as an appeal, and he wrote it originally in Aramaic, as an appeal to the northern barbarians.
Really?
Which are the tribes, the Alans, the Sake, that we know as the Germanic tribes.
Right.
And that's who he wrote it to. And if you read the preface to Wars by Josephus, you'll see that. He wrote it to them that they might know that the outcome of things in Judea. And he really wrote it as an appeal to them.
Okay.
But you know, the appeal was never heard.
Right.
And later on, he wrote it in Greek. He translated it into Greek.
Mm-hmm. So he originally wrote it in Aramaic.
As he states himself in his preface.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so it did. And if Jesus wanted to, he certainly could organize them into an army and bring them back to Judea and kick Jew butt. You know?
Well, right, but it just wasn't to be.
But right, not at this time.
But it was well known that the Parthian connection to the to Jerusalem was well known by learned men at the time,
yeah.
And Josephus was one of them, and the Sacca and the Alans and the other Germanic so-called barbarian tribes of the north.
Mm-hmm.
It was well known at this time by learned men.
Yes, exactly.
But those connections were lost.
Yes. And it's known today by learned men.
Well, right. Well, now I'd like to talk about another thing.
British Israel, right.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about another thing.
Okay.
The Sadducees. Caiaphas was a Sadducee.
Okay.
That can be established right from Scripture. And I don't think a lot of people catch that, and that's why I'm trying to stress it.
Okay.
And the Sadducees were actually in charge of the high priesthood in the temple at this time.
Okay.
And even though the Sadducees were a much smaller party than the Pharisees. They were supported by, as Josephus explains, the wealthy.
Yeah.
The wealthy. They were the rich, liberal elite
mm-hmm.
that denied anything spiritual and transcendent of the physical plane.
Yeah.
You know? And the Pharisees get all the bad press.
Right.
But, you know, Yahshua preached to the Pharisees and taught some Pharisees, if you look back through the Scripture, that there's times when the Sadducees question him,
right.
But he always has bad words for them. He never really even tries to teach the Sadducees,
mm-hmm.
at least that I've seen.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, there were some Judahite Pharisees. And then
but what I'm saying is it's very unlikely that any Judahite Sadducees.
Right, yeah. Well, and, I guess what you're saying is that they would be the Rockefeller Republicans today.
Well, maybe worse.
Yeah.
But Caiaphas was a Sadducee, and I'd like to cite Acts 4, 6, 5, 17, and 18, and John 18, 13, and 14.
Okay.
And Acts 4, 6 says, "And Annas the high priest, and Caiaphas, and John, and Alexander, and as many as were of the kindred of the high priest were gathered together at Jerusalem." So we have Annas and Caiaphas and everybody of their kindred,
mm-hmm.
okay, their race, in other words.
Yes.
Now, Acts 5, 17 and 18. "Then the high priest rose up, and all they that were with him, which is the sect of the Sadducees."
Okay.
"And were filled with indignation,"
mm-hmm.
"and laid their hands on the apostles and put them in a common prison."
Right.
Now, John 18, 13 and 14. "And they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law to Caiaphas."
Uh-huh.
So we see the Sadducees are a race,
right.
a kindred, and a family, and they're related, and they're the high priest of the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they're
yeah.
Sadducees.
Yeah. Well, certainly in the sense of a breed, you know, that some of them could have had Judahite blood, just as many of the Pharisees were full-blooded Judahites. But
most of the Edomites in Judea were mixing with Judahites.
Right. I was just getting ready to say, most of them were half-breeds, and some of them were full-blooded Edomites, you know. But they themselves constituted a party and, you know, ran amongst themselves, and you'd have to consider themselves a breed apart. You know,
well, right. And it's obvious that a lot of them infiltrated the Pharisees.
Yes.
But it seems to me that the Sadducees are strictly Edomites.
Okay.
And that's, it can't be proven.
Mm-hmm.
But where Acts says that the kindred, the race of the high priest, and then in another place is the sect of the Sadducees.
Okay.
That's where they come from.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, I think in both cases, the Sadducees and the Pharisees, they began as a Judahite faction. Okay.
Well, I don't know if I could say that about the Sadducees, but I can say it. I can agree with you about the Sadducees,
yeah.
about the Pharisees.
Okay.
And that's from Josephus and Antiquities Book 13. Yeah.
So you're saying at this point in time, certainly, they've been dominated by the Edomites. Because we're talking 100. If the first Edomite was circumcised in 121 B.C., and here we're talking roughly, 30 A.D., thereabouts. So we're talking 150 years that these Edomites have been in control of Judea. You know, so,
right.
And as we see in America today, once they start taking over the high offices, they fill the high offices with their own people, and crowd the rest of us out. So obviously that's what's going on here. Okay.
Look at Harvard. It's incredibly Jewish now.
Yes,
And the staff and the faculty and the student body.
Yeah, look at Wall Street.
Look at Wall Street, all our banks, all our lobbying firms, Washington. It's incredible.
Yes, yeah, they definitely have taken over all the offices, and they're not Americans. And they're not Israelites either.
Right, and I was discussing a couple of months ago, even in the early 90s when I used to read the Wall Street Journal almost every day, and I'd noticed whenever any article in the Wall Street Journal quoted from experts,
yes,
that regardless the field, they were almost always had Jewish names.
Right, right, yes. Suddenly they're experts. Yeah.
In everything. Whether it was cooking or economics or –
Right.
Or manufacturing, whatever it was.
Yeah, and they would always praise each other. It's like the renowned or the, you know, the, I forget the word they use, the rabbit.
Oh, they fawn over each other consistently
yes.
in archaeology magazines in that same manner.
Yes.
It's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. And so they're always praising themselves. And then the average Christian or average American has no idea that it's just Jews, like in Hollywood. The Academy rewards, okay? It's Jews rewarding Jews.
Yeah, I think Sword Brother and I had a long discussion, and it was taken from, in part, from some of the things that some of the National Socialist writers in Germany wrote, and in part from some of the things that Kevin MacDonald wrote, but the stardom complex comes right from the Jews.
Yes.
The whole stardom concept comes straight from the Jews. It's
mm-hmm.
incredible.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, because it's an economic thing.
And,
you know.
And our race has always had its heroes,
right.
But they want to manufacture them. Our heroes came from like Arminius,
yeah.
you know, or Achilles from great deeds,
right.
from
right.
noble deeds, where the Jews just manufacture men into heroes that never did anything.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you know, they're pretty boys or whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, they couldn't make any money off of Spartacus, but I'm trying to think of the Roman general who was a traitor, and you know his name actually means treason. I can't think of his name right now, but it will come to me. But you know he was one of the first ones who had an army. He actually set up a false enemy so that he could become the victor in a staged battle. And I can't think of his name right now. Maybe it'll come to me. Anyway.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I can't think of the incident.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a major incident. I just can't think of the guy's name. But maybe I'll think of it as we go along. Okay, verse 54. Jesus, therefore, walked no more openly among the Judeans, but went from there to a country near to the wilderness into a city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. And
let me speak about Ephraim a few minutes.
Okay.
Maybe I just made too many notes for this program. I'm sorry. P66. It's a papyrus esteemed to date from around 200 A.D. Has only to a place near the desert called Ephraim.
Okay.
But all the other manuscripts, which aren't as old, have to a city called Ephraim.
City, yeah.
And in my translation, I left to a city called Ephraim, and I did that because P66 is the only Greek witness that the word city doesn't belong there.
Okay.
But I really can't find any record of a city called Ephraim.
Right, right.
Okay. There's an Ephron in Joshua 15:19,
mm-hmm.
and in the Masoretic text in 2 Chronicles 13:19, in the King James, it's Ephraim, Ephrain,
mm-hmm.
but not in the Septuagint. In the Septuagint, it's still clearly Ephron, and I can't imagine that's the place they could be talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I just thought I'd mention that.
Right.
You know, even though the preponderance of manuscripts has a city called Ephraim, the one most ancient papyri does not.
Yes. Yes.
And it's just a place called Ephraim near the desert.
Mm-hmm.
But and the city can't really be
right.
actually identified.
Yes, yes. So the word place may be the most accurate statement here, and it really sounds like it is. Yeah. Verse 55, and the Jews' Passover was near at hand. And many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then sought they for Jesus and spoke among themselves as they stood in the temple. What think you that he will not come to the feast? Do you think he will or do you think he won't? Verse 57. Now both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a commandment that if any man knew where he were, he should show it that they might take him. Okay. So they had put out an all-points bulletin.
Right, and,
yes.
and that take is a little stronger. It should be seize him.
Yes,
and,
right.
And there were Passovers, and John mentioned at 2:13, most likely at 5:1, and at 6:4. And there was a December Feast of Dedication, as we just saw, mentioned at 10:22.
Okay.
So we see that this Gospel of John, mm-hmm. through the first 11 chapters, covers events from the first three
right.
and almost a half years of Yahshua's ministry.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah.
now these last 11 chapters are going to cover 6 days.
Right, right. Very interesting. Okay. All right, so let's see what they have to say. Chapter 12, verse 1. Then Jesus, 6 days before, there's your 6 days, before the Passover came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table with him. Then took Mary a pound of ointment of spikenard, very costly, and anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the odor of the ointment. Question for you, Bill. Is this a second time that she anoints his feet with her hair? Because
I think that when John wrote it before, Yeah, you know, John's writing the gospel.
Right.
Many years after it actually happened.
Okay, so.
And he's writing in the past tense about something that happened in his past, but not yet appeared
right.
in his account.
Yeah, because, well, he mentions it at the beginning of 11, chapter
right.
11.
Right, and right. So, and I think that that's what it is. He's writing in the past
yeah.
about something that happened in his past.
So, okay. Oh,
but,
okay.
But hasn't yet appeared in his account.
Okay. So unless he's being parenthetical here, let me just, it's verse 2, 11:2. Let me read verses 1 and 2, chapter 11. Now a certain man was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair.
And that's a parenthetical statement.
Yeah, that's parenthetical. So he's basically using this statement to make sure that we understand which Mary he's talking about.
Right,
okay.
When we get to that point.
Yeah, and now we're there. Now
yeah.
we're there. Verse 3. Then took Mary a pound of ointment and spikenard, very costly, anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the odor of the ointment. So that parenthetical statement is pointing to this statement, verse 4. Then says one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, which would betray him, why was not this ointment sold for 300 pence and given to the poor?
Simon's son is probably an addition here.
Mm-hmm.
It exists in other Gospels, but it's an addition here.
Okay.
I just thought I'd throw that in.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, in other words, Simon's, okay, which should betray him.
Well, I mean, but the whole word, you know, he's called Judas the son of Simon Iscariot elsewhere.
Okay.
But Simon doesn't exist in the better text here.
I see what you're saying. Okay. All right, so then verse 5, let me repeat verse 5. Why was not this ointment sold for 300 pence and given to the poor? Sounds like a liberal, doesn't he? He wants to give this money to the poor.
Well, this is, John's about to explain.
Let's continue. This, he said, not that he cared for the poor.
Neither do the liberals.
That's right, exactly.
They fed to their own nest.
Exactly. But because he was a thief, like the liberals are thieves, paying off the poor, so-called, the welfare addicts, with our money.
And living off it.
I mean,
the welfare
right.
addicts get like 20% of what's collected,
right.
you know, and the bureaucracy sucks up the rest.
Right, and the liberals get bureaucratic jobs with our money and live better than the poor people who they claim to be serving.
And a lot better
right?
than the poor taxpayers.
It's a racket.
Right.
And Judas is in this racket himself.
Well, there's more because John says he's a thief and
yes.
carries the case holding the savings.
Yes.
That means that he was the treasurer.
That's right.
Judas, the Cana. How typical. Yeah, you know, this is so incredibly stereotypical
right.
that every time I think about this passage, I nearly choke on the irony.
right. exactly. The Jew always holds the money bag. He's always got the money.
Always. And when you think about, for the Federal Reserve,
mm-hmm.
every chairman has been a Jew.
Right.
The founding of this republic, Alexander Hamilton,
right.
first treasurer,
mm-hmm.
the first Judas
right.
of the American Republic.
There you go.
And look at the Confederate States of America. Judah P. Benjamin.
Right.
A Jew from New Orleans was the treasurer.
Right.
The secretary of the treasury.
That's right.
And I don't know how many of these, look at Enron, Andrew Fastow. And you could probably, I don't have the memory for the financial shenanigans of the last 20 years because I've just scoffed at them.
Yeah.
And asked people what they expect. So I don't remember all the names, but.
Yes.
There's Jews behind every one of them.
Right.
And they're always the treasurers, the CFOs,
mm-hmm.
and it's incredible.
Judas, it's
telling us,
mm-hmm.
it's signaling to us that the people that like to control the money are the people selling us down the river.
That's right. That's right, yeah. And they do so because money gives them the control of the people around them. And the society. And that's why they do it. And our people just don't think that way. So it's very clear that Judas is a Jew. okay.
And Christ said, haven't I chosen you 12? And one of you is a devil.
Is this devil.
But he's
right.
also the treasurer.
Exactly.
It's incredible.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's back into the olden days, even the days of Cain. The Kenites, they were the first fabricators of metal, you know, weapons, et cetera, and probably the first fabricators of money, too.
I was going to say, and coins, too.
Yes,
I'm
exactly.
Sure. And coin, actually, our word money is a Hebrew word.
Okay.
The word money, the word mina in Hebrew, all right, but mina was also a word used by the Greeks, probably through their dealings with the Assyrians and the Hebrews. But the word monah in Hebrew, and Strong's transliterates it M-O-N-E-H, means something weighed out. And the Roman equivalent of that word is moneta,
mm-hmm.
M-O-N-E-T-A.
Okay.
And
monetary,
and
yeah.
Basic, right, monetary and money.
Mm-hmm.
That it's all we still use. That monah, that money, is that same Hebrew word from how many thousands of years ago?
Yes.
Some things, I mean, while language evolves, some things really never change.
But we forget.
Yeah,
that
we
never
do.
Changes either.
All right.
Okay. All right, so he complained, I want to have that money bag. I want to have it myself, right? Because, well, he doesn't admit he's a thief.
Well, right. He could have got a bigger cut of that $300.
Exactly. Yeah, he would have stole it all, right?
Absolutely.
Or gotten some really cheap stuff instead of the spike dart, right? Verse 7, then said Jesus, let her alone. Against the day of my burying has she kept this. Very interesting statement here.
Now his prescience alone proves to me that he's Yahweh.
Yeah.
I mean, his prescience, it's something that isn't discussed the time. His prescience concerning day-to-day things, but especially his death.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, he definitely has foreknowledge, no doubt about it, yeah. Okay, verse 8, for the poor always you have with you, but me you have not always. And so we should treasure, you know, obviously the people around him, the Judahites around him understood that, to some extent at least. Verse 9, many of the people of the Judeans therefore knew that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might see Lazarus also, whom he had raised from the dead. Of course, you know, the word had gotten around, and hey, we want to see Lazarus. We thought he was dead. Okay? We want to make sure. I want to see this for myself. Verse 10, but the chief priests consulted that they might put Lazarus also to death. Wow.
And that shows that the Sadducees, that they could never believe in Yahshua, even though they clearly knew what was going on and who he was.
And they want to kill the evidence.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That just shows the mean-spiritedness of these people.
Well, they could only be Satan. They can't
Satan
be anything
inspired
else.
Satan-inspired meanness, absolutely.
But bad people don't do these things.
Right. No.
I mean,
these are evil.
This is beyond Teddy Bundy.
Right. Really. Yeah, exactly. So they wanted to kill Lazarus to kill the evidence that Jesus had raised him from the dead. That's really what they wanted to do. Verse 10, but the chief priests consulted that they might put Lazarus also to death. Because that by reason of him, many of the Jews went away and believed on Jesus. He's cutting into our action. Let's get rid of the evidence, okay?
Losing their control over the people.
That's right. Verse 12.
And that's what all theologians fear most, even today's.
Right. It's power. It's power over the people's minds. Yes. On the next day, many people that were come to the feast, when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, took branches of palm trees and went forth to meet him and cried, Hosanna, blessed is the King of Israel that comes in the name of the Lord. Now, obviously, this proves the point that we were discussing earlier, that those Judahites expected Jesus to be king.
Right, they did. They did not have the Yeah, you know, they read the scriptures and they didn't put together the suffering Messiah scriptures with the exultant conquering Messiah scriptures.
Yes.
They expected him to be king.
Right.
And that they ignored all the scriptures that he had to die.
Right.
And that's what the apostles had a great struggle with.
Yes, yes. And And even the apostles didn't really comprehend that either.
Oh, well, not until long after it happened.
Yes, yeah. So at this point, no one ever thought in those terms that you're describing now.
No,
the
not
suffering
at all.
Messiah. And then also they were under Roman domination, you know. So they wanted to be liberated from that.
Well, right. And if you read the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Dead Sea Scrolls, those people were not Christians by any means.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They had no concept of Christianity whatsoever. And it can't be proven when they were written, except that they were definitely written in between, I'm going to throw two dates out, 60 B.C. and 60 A.D.
Okay.
And that's because the Rome didn't have full control over Judea until after 70 B.C.
Right.
And the wars of 65 to 70 A.D. are unknown to the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Okay.
Jerusalem still stands. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the Romans control Judea.
Yeah.
And the Dead Sea Scroll writers, if you read the War Scroll, they believed that their Messiah would come and rescue them from what they called the Empire of the Kittim, which is, you know, the Kittim were Japhethites,
yeah.
And they pictured the Romans and the Greeks as Kittim, and that would, you know, they called the Roman Empire the Empire of the Kittim,
mm-hmm.
and they believed that their Messiah would lead them into a final battle against the Empire of the Kittim and destroy it, and they would be the remnant left, and they would rule forever.
Yeah, no, Kittim was actually a territory in those days. Are they using the word Kittim in a broader sense here?
Well, yeah. Okay. I mean, it was the islands, you know, the peoples of the islands were generally considered Kittim, and it's rather ignorantly also, because many of them were actually Israelites.
Right.
But they were generally considered Kittim by the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah.
And I don't find the same analogy in other literature.
Right, right. So what do you think the dating is of that then?
It's definitely during that period. It's definitely the Dead Sea Scrolls, because of the War Scroll and similar writings like it, the Dead Sea Scrolls were definitely written, and when I say that, I don't mean the biblical copies of,
right,
of
yeah,
scripture
okay.
found
the
among
War
Dead
Scroll and those kinds.
Yeah,
of
yeah, the War Scroll and the actual documents of the sect that,
yes.
that created the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Okay,
those they definitely wrote between 60 B.C. and 60 A.D.
Okay,
but they knew not Christianity.
Right,
and they actually upheld a lot of the doctrines of the Pharisees that Christ. That Christ scoffed at.
Well,
even in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it says that you cannot pull your brother out of a well or an animal out of a ditch on the Sabbath.
On the Sabbath. Interesting.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay. Very good. Okay, so, and then verse 14, and Jesus, when he had found a young ass, sat thereon, as it is written, Zechariah 9:9.
Yes, Zechariah 9:9, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem, behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just, having salvation,
okay.
lowly, and riding upon an ass,
okay.
and upon a colt, the foal of an ass.
Right, and that's what verse 15 says in fewer words. Fear not, daughter of Zion. Behold, your king comes sitting on an ass's colt. Verse 16, these things understood not his disciples at the first. But when Jesus was glorified, then remembered they that these things were written of him and that they had done these things to him. So obviously when you're in the moment, you don't think, hey, he's fulfilling prophecy here.
Well, right.
Right.
That's because prophecy is not written so that men can observe the times and tell the future.
Right.
Prophecy is written so that in retrospect, men can know that God is true.
Right, yeah. And hopefully we can recognize it when it's happening. That's the ideal situation.
Right. But what I'm saying is that ain't going to happen.
Oh, right, it's not going to happen.
I mean,
very often.
You know, we think we recognize the ends of the end days today
right.
in what's going on. But it could be another 50 years or
sure.
100 years.
Sure.
How small a remnant do you want, you know?
Right, exactly. The longer it takes, the smaller the remnant.
Right,
they're going.
Basically.
Yeah, right. Verse 17, the people therefore that was with him when he called Lazarus out of his grave and raised him from the dead bore record, okay, right thing to do. They bore record. They kept the, you know, a written record of what was going on here. Verse 18.
Well, I'm sorry.
Oh, right.
That's not how I read this. Therefore, the crowd had testified, which had been with him when he called Lazarus from out of the tomb.
In other words,
that they're glorifying him and magnifying him in this manner upon his entrance into Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
That is their testimony.
Right. So they were praising him. Okay, verse 18. For this cause the people also met him, for that they heard that he had done this miracle. So this miracle of Lazarus was a really big deal, folks. Verse 19.
And let me just say that word miracle, it's really just sign.
Yeah.
That's all the Greek word is a sign.
Okay. The Pharisees therefore said among themselves, "Perceive you how you prevail nothing? Behold, the world has gone after him."
Well, right. They're basically scoffing at scoffing.
Right. Yeah. We're losing our power. Everybody's following him. This ain't good, folks. Or among themselves, of course. Verse 20. And there were certain Greeks among them that came up to worship at the feast. And the same came therefore to Philip, which was of Bethsaida of Galilee, and desired him, saying, "Sir, we would see Jesus." Philip comes and tells Andrew, and again Andrew and Philip tell Jesus. And Jesus answered them, saying, "The hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Verily, verily, I say to you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abides alone, but if it die, it brings forth much fruit." Okay, there, Jesus prophesying the Christian era.
And Paul basically makes the same analogy. He borrows this analogy, and I believe it's 1 Corinthians chapter 15 of us, that when we die, the fruit of our bodily life is our spiritual existence.
Okay. Very good. Verse 25, "He that loves his life shall lose it, and he that hates his life in this world shall keep it to life eternal." More proof, folks, that we do our consciousness does not die with bodily death. Verse 26.
And I have some comments on that.
Okay.
You know, many commentators interpret verse 25 as an ascetic statement.
Ascetic?
And to me, yeah, ascetic. Ascetic, like live an austere life. And that's the, you know, like,
really?
Go dwell in a cave and become a monk. And to me, asceticism is almost always a false asceticism.
Well, yeah.
I can't say the word. I'm sorry.
Asceticism.
I can spell it.
Asceticism. But there's no asceticism in the Bible. None.
None whatsoever, and that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And a lot of commentators take this statement and others like it and try to say that it promotes asceticism.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm trying to say that that's asceticism to me is false piety.
Right, exactly. Yeah, well, the Catholic Church had all these ascetic type monk orders, you know.
They're all vain.
Yeah, yeah, and would wear hair shirts and stuff. As if that made the world a better place.
And it's the sin of the world that we're to reject.
Exactly.
You know, James in his epistle at 4:4 says, "Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that friendship of the world is enmity with God?" And the world is a sinful place, and that's what we're supposed to reject.
I never made the connection before, but this concept of asceticism, which is basically putting yourself in the wilderness, whether it's out in a cave somewhere or whether it's just an attitude of isolating yourself away from your friends, family, and moral duties, etc., in order to become holy or spiritual. The Bible doesn't teach that. It doesn't teach that at all. Okay?
And there's a couple of there's a couple of examples of it, like John the Baptist.
Right.
But they were special, and they were chosen for a special task.
Well, yeah, I mean, you separate yourself to prepare yourself to come back to the world to fulfill your function, not to just withdraw from society forever until you die. There's nothing like that in the Bible.
Well, right, but I'm just trying to the hatred of the world is the hatred of its sin.
Right,
and its error,
exactly.
And it's not the hatred of the... Of the basic comforts of life.
Well, you're not to abandon your family and
well,
your
right,
friends, etc., etc. You're not supposed to do that.
That too, but Christians don't have to do without the comfort,
right.
the basic comforts of life.
But this That's whole idea it. Sounds like the forerunner of the gospel of personal salvation. Okay.
Well yeah, right.
Okay. See, all I'm concerned about is me.
So you go wear a hair shirt and run around the forest.
Exactly,
for 20 years.
Exactly. That's how silly this is, right? But how are you supposed to be tested if you're in a cave? You're not going to be tested in a cave. You're basically wasting your life. That's
no, you have to be tested in the world.
Exactly.
And you can't look out for your brethren and love your brother in a cave.
That's right. That's right. So asceticism and, you know, all these monk orders, et cetera, are totally vain. Absolutely vain.
Right. And I'm just trying to make an illustration that hatred of the world is not asceticism.
Right.
Asceticism is not the answer, you know.
Okay. Let's see. Brett, this verse is also Yahweh telling us Adamics to do his will only. Are you talking about verse 25? Well, yes, certainly. Yeah, and the life we have in the future, you know, in heaven, you can call it heaven, but our eternal life, we earn it here, okay? We got to do the right things here, and we lose our physical life to earn eternal life. You know, so our focus must be eternal life, not this life, which is the focus of the Jews, because they don't have an eternal life, and they certainly don't believe in eternal life.
And that's just like the gospel of personal salvation. The ascetics don't know anything about the true gospel kingdom message.
Yeah.
Because they deny or fail to consider it.
Right.
The racial message, the kingdom message of Scripture.
Yeah, absolutely. And the amazing thing about that, Bill, is that the parables, virtually every parable starts with Jesus saying, the kingdom is such and such. The kingdom is such and such.
Well, I think I demonstrated back a few months ago that most of those parables pertain to race.
Right. And certainly the kingdom, which is, you know, is to come, but the kingdom is already here in us. If we would but establish it, okay? And so the focus is the kingdom, not personal salvation. Personal salvation and the kingdom, really, they go hand in hand, but you can't focus on self. You have to focus on the kingdom, okay? And I think that's what he's certainly trying to tell us here, and that's why it must be based on interpersonal relationships of us Adamites, okay? It's not a purely personal thing. It's a social thing among us. Verse 26.
Well, that's why we'll see. I'm sorry. In verse, yes. I think it's in chapter 13 where it begins. The prevalence of the message of brotherly love.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yeah. And that's another thing the gospel of personal salvation avoids. Brotherly love. They avoid that concept, and they replace it with
every man for himself.
Right. That's right.
Basically,
spiritually speaking, yeah. Every man for himself. What do I have to do to be saved? And it never occurs to them, love your brother. It never occurs to them. It's amazing.
And figure out who your brother is.
Exactly.
So it's important part of that.
Right. Verse 26. If any man serve me, let him follow me, and where I am, there shall also my servant be. If any man serve me, him will my Father honor. As I was saying, the kingdom is here already. It's in us. It's in us in potential if we would but create it. Verse 27, now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this cause came I to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then, of course, he's anticipating, you know, his ordeal. Then came there a voice from heaven saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again, referring to the name of Yahweh. Verse 29, the people therefore that stood by and heard it said that it thundered. Others said an angel spoke to them. So people had different.
Well, I just wonder if perhaps the hearing of the crowd was divided, just like it's divided in the hearing of the gospel.
Right.
Along those same lines.
Right.
Meaning the racial lines.
Okay.
The genetic lines.
Yes.
And I have to say, it's only speculation, but
okay.
It's a strong urge to, for me
right.
to to perceive it that way.
Right. So you're taking the word thundered literally then.
Well, they heard a loud noise.
They had
in other words, the Edomites in the crowd heard a loud noise.
Yeah.
The good people of God in the crowd heard voice.
They heard a voice, and they understood the voice.
And that's conjecture on my part, believe
right.
me.
No,
but it's just an irresistible conjecture.
Right. Yes, very good. Verse 30, Jesus answered and said, "This voice came not because of me, but for your sakes." Now, and of course, he came for us, right? He didn't come for himself. He came for us. Verse 31. Now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the prince of this world be cast out. Now, of course, that hasn't happened yet.
Well, it didn't. It happened
spiritually
with the acceptance of Christianity by the preponderance of our race.
Right.
It happened.
Yes,
then after 1,000 years, Satan was let loose again.
Right, right. So that the coming of the this is the beginning of the kingdom here.
Right, it's the beginning.
It's the beginning.
And it took 500 years to bind Satan.
Okay.
I mean, it was there was a long period of Satan-inspired or Jewish, Edomite, Antichrist, however you want to term them, inspired persecutions of Christians.
Right.
And they used the other white peoples to do that, to persecute the Christians.
Right, yes.
That's the Roman government. And then when the Roman government finally adopted Christianity, under the reign of Theodosius II, I believe, Satan was locked up for good with the excoriation of the Jews from society.
Okay. Okay.
And the outlawing of
that would
usury.
Be the beginning of 1,000 years. You're saying
and the outlawing of usury. Yes,
okay.
That was the beginning of 1,000 years.
Okay, very good.
And I believe Satan was let out of the pit when the De Medicis had the Catholic Church change the definition of usury, and the Jews could buy their way into everything again.
Right. Yes.
And it took 500 years to bind Satan, and it's taken 500 years to totally unbind Satan.
And
now today it's wide open. Satan runs wide open, and Satan's proud to be Satan.
And
it's a good thing to be a Jew again.
Right. And we know from previous verses that Satan holds the money. he's got the money bags.
And he always has.
Okay. Verse 32, "And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to me." Now, the word men is added. I think, what do you think here? Did they add it to try to suggest that all the people of all races should be drawn unto him?
The all has to be defined from Scripture.
Right. And it can only be
Israel. I mean, the whole gospel message is to all Israel.
Yeah, I come not but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So those are the all that he's talking about.
Yes, and he's not talking about those Sadducees that want to kill him and Lazarus.
Or the Pharisees that want to kill
him. Right, he has no interest in them at all.
And then the Jews who have no belief in him whatsoever and no interest in him whatsoever and aren't his race either. Okay. Verse 33. "This he said, signifying what death he should die. The people answered him, 'We have heard out of the law that Christ abides forever. And how say you the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is
now,
this Son of Man?'"
Let me see that word does literally mean lifted up. And that's how it is in my translation too.
Okay.
But they used it as an analogy for crucifixion.
Yes.
That they knew he meant crucifixion.
Okay. There's a question in the chat. About when you think Satan was bound, the actual date, because we're talking about the 1,000-year binding.
Well, it's a process. It's not an actual date.
Yeah.
And with the process started with Constantine, who decriminalized Christianity.
Uh-huh.
All right? And then under Theodosius, it was made the official religion of the empire, okay? And that set the stage for Justinian, who consolidated the power in the hands of the Bishop of Rome, which in some ways was a good thing, and I hate to say that. It was in most ways it was a bad thing.
Uh-huh.
But what it did do when there were good bishops of Rome is they outlawed usury. They outlawed Jewish owning of Christian slaves.
Okay.
They took all power out of the hands of the Jews.
Right.
They outlawed Jews from holding public office.
Mm-hmm.
They did a lot of good things. That locked Satan into the pit.
Mm-hmm.
That found Satan in the pit. And Satan was let out of the pit 1,000 years later, begetting, and this too is a long process. It didn't happen on any specific date,
mm-hmm.
just like it didn't begin on any specific date.
Right.
But it was a long process, and it started when the Catholic Church redefined usury.
Okay.
And they redefined usury from interest on money to too much interest
right.
on money. And that basically, what that did was that gave Christians license to start borrowing money
right.
from who?
Right.
The Jews.
Exactly.
And that, well, now that might seem innocuous, but that's absolutely evil, because
uh-huh.
that is how the Jews have gotten control of all our wealth
right.
over the last 400 or 500
years. Yeah, and you see today the churches don't teach anything against usury anymore.
None.
The churches are totally in league with the devil on usury.
All the German reformers were against usury, and Calvin accepted it.
Yeah.
And most American Protestants were against usury,
yeah.
and Cotton Mather accepted it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And talked the New England Baptists, you
right.
know, the New English,
and
New
Calvin's
Protestant.
Real name was Cohen.
So there's a lot of, you know,
that
usury. Explains
that.
It's not a mistake.
Uh-huh.
By mistake that usury, you know, the Hebrew idiom was a snake bite.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the word
right.
they used for usury
right.
was. Like,
well, gosh. Yeah, they got to inject, they inject their poison little by little.
Well, right, and people mm-hmm. think it's innocuous, but it's evil. When
right.
when one person in a community has license to create money and loan it out at interest,
mm-hmm.
the inevitable outcome is that that person owns everything
yeah.
in the community.
Right.
And it might take 200 years, but it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is how the Jew has gained control over Christendom again.
Right.
Through
right.
the power of the creation of money and usury.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's an old Babylonian trick.
And for 1,000 years, usury was absolutely banished from Christendom.
Right, right. Yes, very good. Okay, so verse 35, then Jesus said to them, little while is the light with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness come upon you. For he that walks in darkness knows not where he goes. And that describes Judeo-Christianity today, folks. It describes the entire planet, verse 36. While you have light, believe in the light, that you may be the children of the light. These things spoke Jesus and departed and did hide himself from them. Okay, so he's getting ready. Verse 37, but though he had done so many miracles before them, yet they believed not on him.
And they knew it. They knew who
yeah.
he was. They knew he made the signs.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's disputing that he didn't make them.
Right.
But they still
yeah.
have to kill him.
Right.
They have to be that old serpent. I mean, there's no
right.
doubt.
Right. Yeah, so they believed not. Verse 38. Well, I mean, they knew, but they still, because they didn't want to believe. They didn't want it. They didn't want
to right. There's some of them that were, and John explains it when we get to 43.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, it's those Edomite Sadducees that
right.
have the power and control,
yeah.
and therefore the esteem of the even the good, many of the good people.
Right, right. Yeah, like Glenn Beck.
Yeah, right.
People
exactly.
esteem, some of our people still esteem
with
Glenn Beck.
Puerto Rican children.
Yeah, right. Okay, yeah. Verse 38, that the saying of Isaiah, the prophet, might be fulfilled, which he spoke, Lord, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Therefore, they could not believe, because that Isaiah said again, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, that they should not see with their eyes nor understand with their heart, and be converted, and I should heal them. Of course.
Now that has to be said of Judahites.
Right.
There
absolutely.
Is no doubt.
Yeah.
This is that verse in Isaiah, that's from Isaiah chapter 6.
Okay.
The first one, you know, who has believed our report, that's from Isaiah chapter 53. This is from Isaiah chapter 6. It's quoted 5 or 6 times by Paul and in several of the Gospels.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that it illustrates the fate of those Judahites who rejected
right.
Yeah, you know, who rejected Christ in favor of the world or the Edomites in control of the world and their opinions, and they will suffer the consequences of that rejection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course that's still going on today, and you know that's because we've had a number of discussions about the white nationalist movement. You know, who are many of them, if not most of them, are in fact Israelites, but they utterly reject, religion to begin with, and Jesus Christ in particular. And so the Jews have maneuvered them into rejecting their own Messiah.
Okay? Well, right, absolutely.
Yes.
And they don't realize when you're anti-Christian and you're white, you have bought Jewish doctrines pot and parcel.
Yes.
You have played right into the hands of the Jews.
Yes.
And the Jews love you. The Jews loved the pagans in the 5th and 6th centuries.
Yes.
The
right.
Jews and the pagans got along just swell.
Yeah.
The Jews hated the spread of Christianity. Because Christianity excoriates and makes manifest the evil deeds of the Jew.
Right.
And only Christianity does that.
Exactly. And the pagans are actually practicing those old Canaanite rituals, which the Jews do in secret.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, they do them in secret, but not publicly.
Paganism is actually Canaanitism.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Okay. All right, so these things said Isaiah, when he saw his glory and spoke of him. So Isaiah foresaw this. Verse 42. Nevertheless, among the chief rulers also many believed on him. Of course, we said earlier that many of the Pharisees were in fact Judahites. Okay? And I believe also some of the Sadducees were. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. Okay? So either now you make your deal with the world, or, you know, with the kingdom. Okay? So you'd have to choose. You can't do them both. Verse 43, for they love the praise of men more than the praise of God. Verse 44, Jesus cried and said, he that believes on me believes not on me, but on him that sent me. Of course, Yahweh. Verse 45, and he that sees me sees him that sent me. I am come a light into the world, that whosoever believes on me should not abide in darkness. And I think we can get to the end of the chapter here for this show. And if any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not, for I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. Of course.
The next time he comes, it'll be to judge the world.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, here he explains, you know, I have another advent to take care of.
Well, but, absolutely, and that's that word "world" is society in my translation.
Right, right, and so, but obviously, in the heat of the moment, very, very few people could understand exactly what he's talking about, you know. And in fact, he had prophesied his coming death a number of times, and people would just, you know, shrug it off and say, "What's he talking about? You know, let's party." Verse 48: He that rejects me and receives not my words has one that judges him. The word that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day. Well, folks, you know, there's going to be a judge. There is a last day. There is going to be a last day. Verse 49, for I have not spoken of myself, but the Father which sent me, he gave me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his commandment is life everlasting. The law, folks, is life everlasting. Whatsoever I speak, therefore, even as the Father said to me, so I speak. Okay, so there's no change in the doctrine. There's no change in the commandments, except, of course, as we've discussed many times, the rituals and oblations no longer apply.
Well, that was a part of the commandments.
Right, at the time, yes.
You know, that's a part of the law and the prophets, that Levitical priesthood and those rituals would be done away with.
Right, yeah. And so that was prophesied, and anything that was not prophesied to be done away with, you know, which the antinomians think it was all done away with, okay, and which is a lie, because it was not prophesied. They simply misuse, what is all? All is a pronoun, I guess, in this case.
Well, Yahshua Christ is Yahweh come in the flesh, and he says, if you love me, keep my commandments.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Abraham, you know, there's laws that are manifest to us outside of the Levitical law.
Mm-hmm.
And Abraham in Genesis chapter 25
kept
Yahweh's laws, statutes, and judgments.
Right, right. Yeah, and then when we start Galatians tomorrow, we'll find out that the Judeos and the antinomians love to misinterpret Paul, especially in Galatians and in Colossians. They just love to misinterpret the, you know, so we'll get into the question of law starting tomorrow night. So, okay, so since we only have a couple minutes left, we won't bother going into John chapter 13.
That's good, because I don't have any notes yet for John chapter 13.
Okay, very good. So, but, yeah, the basic message here, besides, you know, the identity message that we're used to, that the Gospels are for us, the true Israelites of the world, is there are non-Israelites that the Messiah has no interest in converting, as in verse 40 in chapter 12 that we just discussed. And he also says the same thing in Matthew 13:15, that there are certain people that he will not heal lest they be converted. Okay? So it's very obvious that that these Gospels are telling us that there's two kinds of people. And, of course, Matthew 25, I believe it starts in verse 32, where he divides the world into sheep and goats.
Okay. And they're nations.
Yes, they're nations.
The sheep are nations and the goats are nations.
Right.
And you know, a lot of people like to they like to pick on the things that he says about visiting the sick and the prisoners and this and that.
Right.
And insist that means individuals. But what I would say is that means that there are nations who generally perform the will of God, mm-hmm. and there are nations which can't.
Right.
And only one type of people in this entire world has ever built a hospital or a prison in the first place.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah, and the other ones that build banks.
Well, right, but I mean the other races, they never built hospitals, prisons, or banks.
Right, right, yes. Yeah,
they're outside of the scope of the scripture altogether.
Yeah. So clearly the race that builds banks and the race that builds hospitals directly descend from Genesis 3:15. So simply no doubt
Absolutely.
About it.
Absolutely. Except that today the race that builds banks, most of them own the hospitals
and
names.
Because they built them with borrowed money or loaned money in from their perspective. Right.
Well, we built them and they own them.
Exactly.
You know, that's
exactly.
The way it is.
And Isaiah prophesied that we would, and in fact it goes back to Deuteronomy, we shall build, but someone else will own it. Okay, and that's what's happened, folks, through usury, through fractional reserve banking. And we can clearly see that the two seed line message is running throughout these Gospels. If you understand that there's a certain group of people that cannot be converted, and there's a certain people that cannot, for the life of them, they can't seem to do anything good. Whatever they do turns out to be evil. Okay. Because
absolutely. I mean, look at it over there.
Yeah.
Look at it in Palestine.
Right. Yeah, there's nothing good that's come out of Palestine in 60 years.
With their 50-mile or 100-mile serpentine wall.
Exactly. Exactly. So, folks, two-seed line is undeniable. I'm not sure, because I know both of us had the correspondence with Ted Weiland during the last week.
Well, basically, I didn't really correspond with him,
okay.
Except that I saw that he was on a list that I was on in a mailing, and I thought I'd take advantage of that because he said something bad about he said something negative about Clifton.
Okay.
In a response to a mailing of somebody else.
Yeah, they've gone back and forth. Yeah.
Right. So I snatched his. I wrote him in prison. And I really didn't write him a bad letter, but I wrote him a letter from prison challenging him that he never answered. And Clifton printed it, and it's somewhere on Christogenia.
Okay.
And what I did was I snatched his email address out of the CC list, and I sent him a copy of Shemitic Idioms in Genesis chapter 3,
okay.
the paper I wrote. And I said, here, Ted, pick this apart. I think you're a turkey, and I'll debate you on two seed line anytime you want.
Right, right, yeah.
And I left it right at that, and I sent it off to him.
Yeah, and he'll never debate a two seed liner. He'll write books about it, but he will never debate us. Right.
Well, every time I see his name, I'm going to send him something.
But the reason I brought it up was because I'm not convinced that the anti seed liners within the identity movement. I never hear them condemning race mixing. I mean, have you heard any of them? You know, Do they think race fixing is good? What's their opinion?
Let me tell you, Clifton has been beating the drum for a long time that anti-two-seed line is a back door down the path to universalism.
Okay.
And it is.
Okay.
The end result of that perverted philosophy is universalism.
Right, right.
And you know, Clifton, a lot of people think Clifton's out there for saying that, but if you really sit down and think about the consequences, it's true.
Right.
And the look at Pete Peters got his Negro of the Month Club going.
Right.
Yeah, you know, when you go one seed line or anti-two seed line, Ted Whelan bragged about sending Bibles to Nigeria.
Right.
And Clifton wrote about that. So Ted Whelan, he's a closet universalist.
Yeah.
All of those, they got to all be crypto Jews.
So they can't be, you know, what they must be doing then is they're
diluting identity. That's
they're
what
diluting
they're doing.
It, yeah.
To me, identity is two seed line.
Yeah.
If you are not two seed line, you're not Christian identity.
Yeah.
Because you can't identify all the parties of the Bible.
Right. Well, then they must believe then that the Jews can be converted. Okay. Because two seed line teaches that they can't be converted, and the Bible very clearly says that they can't be converted.
Well, right, and when you look at Neil Mellor and some of the things, well, he's probably a Jew anyway.
Okay.
But when you look at some of the like Charles Weissman and all those turkeys, well, when you look at some of the things, I should call them clowns. I don't want to lose my clown word.
right.
When you look at the things they write, yes, they believe that the Jews can be converted.
Uh-huh.
That they believe that they don't believe that it's genetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, very good. Okay. And it is definitely genetic. There's no doubt about that. Yeah.
Why would an identity pastor send Bibles to Nigeria
and
then brag about it? If I did that, I'd hang myself.
Yeah, right.
From the shame of my lapse.
You can see how much good that's done.
Africa. We've been sending them there for 500 years, and they still don't get it.
That's right, and they're still murdering whites, and they're going back to cannibalism.
I think Ted Whelan should go to Nigeria and bring them the Bible.
There you go. Yeah,
and maybe be lunch.
Yeah. So, in other words, what's going on, and this is how my take pretty well on most of British Israel too, is that they talk the talk of the Caucasian race being Israel, and that and there's no doubt that all the promises and the covenants are only to Caucasian Israel and to no one else.
They still don't get to come out from among them and
be
separate part.
Right. Right.
That's the hard part.
And it's kind of like there's like an inner urge they feel. They want to save everybody, okay? And it's like for some reason, you know, I've never felt this urge to save people, you know? I just want to do right, you know, and then saving people from their perspective has little or nothing to do with obeying God's law. Okay. It's an emotional thing. It's an emotional thing for them. And then rather than obey God's law, they want to make themselves feel good and think that they're doing good by trying to convert other races. Okay. And bring them into the covenant. That's ridiculous.
The
white race cannot do what it needs to do if it dilutes its genetics. It can't do it.
That there is absolutely no disparity between God's word and God's creation.
Right.
And for 80 generations, our race has believed that anything white is good and anything black is evil.
Mm-hmm.
And it does really boil down to those two things.
Yeah.
And the word black, the English, I'm going to assert that it comes from the Hebrew word palak, P-A-L-A-Q,
mm-hmm.
would be Strong's transliteration.
Okay.
And that means a plague.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the word that we also get the English word plague
right.
from.
Well, it's obvious that before the white missionaries went into the heart of darkest Africa, they were all cannibals eating each other. Okay?
And so would the well, I don't want to call them Indians, the tribes of South America.
Okay, yes.
And so would the easternmost
right.
Asians,
right.
the yellow people. They were the same way.
Yeah, yeah. And after 500 years of throwing Bibles at them, they're becoming cannibals again. That's the bottom line, you know. So it's not our place. We're supposed to concern ourselves with our own salvation, okay? and let the chips fall where they may, you know. And the Jews are an incidental, you know, they have wormed their way into our society and caused these disputes that we have among ourselves, okay? And so from my perspective, only Two Seed Line comprehends the evil the Jews have done in terms of diluting our seed and destroying our society. And every attempt to convert them has met with absolute failure.
Well, right. And I like to take Two Seed Line a step further than just the Jews, because as far as I'm concerned, there's only two races in the entire earth, and that's the sheep and goats.
Okay, yeah.
And so, their nations.
Yeah, so we have to worry about the sheep.
And yes.
Get the sheep behaving properly, and then the goats will take care of themselves. Okay.
Well,
right.
Yahshua told us he'd take care of the goats.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Very good. All right, so let's continue this discussion next Friday. We'll get into Chapter 13, and it's a fun show again, folks. And tomorrow we're going to start on the Book of Galatians. At long last, we put this off because both of us have had to take a Saturday off on consecutive Saturdays. So we are going to start the Book of Galatians. I'm very much looking forward to that. And so I'll be looking forward to seeing you all tomorrow night. So thank you, Pastor Fink. Talk to you tomorrow. Yahweh bless.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.